with the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. I'm not in California. I made the trek over the weekend to Florida to help our parent company, AgNet Media, host the Citrus and Specialty Crop Expo this week. It's geared for all, as you heard, citrus and specialty crop producers in Florida and the neighboring states. The two-day show is packed with seminars as well as an exhibitor trade show. Stay tuned as I'll continue to provide you with coverage of the show during the week. But for now, let's go ahead and jump into today's show headlines. The House Farm Bill will address California's Prop 12. The House Ag Committee Chair says he plans to use the upcoming Farm Bill to deal with California's Prop 12 that was upheld by the Supreme Court. Roll Call says pork producers across the country have said that this will lead to patchwork laws between states that will interfere with commerce. At Minnesota's Farm Fest, Glenn G.T. Thompson said the Supreme Court did say in its decision that Congress has the power to address the issue caused by Prop 12. However, Congress has chosen not to deal with those issues in the past. Thompson addressed the audience during a Farm Bill listening session and said that the court let it stand because they're tired of handling congressional work. Thompson didn't specify if the Ag Committee could write its own legislation or use pending legislation to deal with California's law. Bills have already been introduced in both congressional chambers that would nullify their proposition. NAFB contributed to that report. And now here's AgNet West Brian German with more agriculture news.
Growers have a threshold consideration for dealing with grapevine red blotch virus. Professor of plant pathology at Cornell University, Mark Fuchs, said there's an economic line in the sand for addressing infections in vineyards.
My recommendation has based on earlier work I've been able to do with ag economists. And these ag economists have basically estimated the financial impact of red blotch and came up with a theoretical incidence level above which growers are recommended to eliminate the entire block because they are losing money versus if they are below that threshold, do roguing. Roguing means the elimination of diseased vines and their replacements with clean vines. And that theoretical threshold is 30%.
The Citrus Research Board will be holding the 2023 board nominations online September 12th and 13th for districts 1, 2, and 3. The next three-year term of office for expiring positions will begin on October 1st and will continue through September 30th, 2026. The first meeting will begin at 9 a.m. on Tuesday, September 12th for the California Desert Region of District 3. There's one position requiring nominations for the district. The District 2 meeting, which encompasses coastal regions of Southern California, will be hosting a meeting at 10 a.m. on September 12th. District 2 has two open positions. The District 1 meeting for Northern California will be held on Wednesday, September 13th, beginning at 9 a.m. There are five positions requiring nominations for District 1. More information about the meetings is available at citrusresearch.org. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Grant opportunities for new producers. Grants worth $15,000 are up for grabs for new and beginning farmers and ranchers, but the deadline to apply is quickly approaching. Accessing startup funds can be challenging for new farmers and ranchers, which is why AgWest Farm Credit developed a program to support the growth of those producers. To be eligible for the one-time $15,000 grants, applicants must be a full or part-time agriculturalist who has 2 years or less of operational experience or has plans to start their operation within 2 years of the grant application date. Their operation has to be located within AgWest Farm Credit's territory, and they can't be a current AgWest lending customer. They also must be 18 years of age and a U.S. citizen. There are a few steps that producers must do before applying, including reviewing the Strategic Business Planning Guide, preparing a business plan and cash flow budget, as well as writing an essay on how the grant will support your business goals. The deadline to apply is August 31st. If you'd like to find out more information or to submit an application, you can visit agwestfc.com. You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
What GMO crops are grown and sold in the U.S.? Well, there's corn, like me, soybeans, canola, sugar beets, and cotton. Typically, were ingredients in certain foods. GMO alfalfa, corn, soybeans, canola, and cotton are used as animal food. And while you won't find many GMOs in the produce section, there are versions of GMO apple, summer squash, potato, and papaya in a few markets. Feed your mind with more GMO knowledge on FDA's website.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, the spotlight is still on the 2023 Farm Bill. During the August recess, lawmakers are in their home districts and traveling around to hear from farmers and others in the industry to find out what they want to see in the Farm Bill. A Farm Bill listening session was held last week in North Dakota and was attended by ranking member of the Senate Agriculture Committee, John Bozeman of Arkansas. He heard from farmers like Andrew Mock, who grows corn.
Ditto a lot of what other people have said around the table here. I'm a fourth generation farmer. I want my kids to farm. A lot of these things is coming back to that. We want to farm, we want to grow a crop, we want to produce the things that we can do in our particular area for the world. So for us, obviously the big push is protect crop insurance, and to strengthen it, with reference price increases or different things. Really, if we can give us the tools is what we're kind of looking for to be able to do the things efficiently and let us choose what, whether it's the price level that we want, maybe making some of them higher reference price or higher prices, percentages, more affordable, this and that for us, and then we can kind of pick and choose a little bit there. We're trying to do everything we can efficiently. Whether it's water management, drain tile, different things like that. We just want to do. They're not creating more land out there, so we want to be as efficient and as whatnot as possible. I'd say PP is a big deal for us, preventive planning, in the fact of our growing season is quite a bit shorter up here than a lot of the other areas. So being able to do that, but there again, we're in the business of producing a crop. So we want to be able to do that. It's just more of the safety net falling back. So I guess I'll just keep it short. Want to say thank you for this. This is a really good opportunity for all of us, and we really appreciate you guys taking your time out of your busy schedules to hear this.
And soybean grower Casey Bitts.
Like Andrew said, and like kind of the conversation is, bringing back rural America, and that kind of starts with young and beginning farmers, I feel. We need to continue to support those programs kind of going forward, making sure there's access to opportunities for young and beginning farmers so that we don't hear the horror stories of the 80s that, many of our parents or grandparents or whoever went through. So that's something that, soybean and obviously all other farmer groups are concerned with too, bringing back rural America and the strength. For soybean, obviously expanding trade promotion programs to help grow and diversify agriculture markets. We're excited for North Dakota soybean farmers and producers here in the state with the expansion of our crush facilities coming online soon. That we'll have the opportunity to work with Marathon, to work with those bio-based fuels going forward. So kind of piggyback off that, then continue to have biofuel opportunities to help the nation become more energy independent. We're excited with the biofuel options, sustainable aviation fuel, kind of going forward, that there's more opportunities for our products, but also continue to develop those markets as well instead of just sending whole beans to China. Obviously. Dr. Wilson mentioned, the global impact with, the concerns going forward, that we need more markets, continue to develop that going forward. And then, obviously, being in D.C., kind of the concerns that we've heard is, maintaining the farmer finance, soybean research and promotion checkoff. Checkoffs are very important to us going forward. The United Soybean Board does a great job in supporting us, but we need, the continued support for the checkoff programs going forward. And just looking to continue here this meeting today and see what else pops up today. So thank you for your time.
Other growers mentioned similar concerns and thoughts during the meeting. That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, according to new data, milk's lead over plant-based beverages is widening in price, nutrition, and consumption volume. During a recent interview with RFD-TV, National Milk Producers Federation Senior Vice President of Communications, Alan Birga, discussed the shifting consumer preference towards milk over plant-based beverages.
You know, after years of listening to the hype about how plant-based beverages were going to herald this new future in what people would consider milk, a lot of the bloom has fallen off. If you take a look at some of the sales data, you see that consumption of such beverages is actually declining year over year. We haven't been seeing this happening. But you take a look at some of the category leaders like oats, almonds, soy, it's just sluggish. People are losing their taste for this beverage. Frankly, with consumer education, understanding that a lot of these sustainability and health benefits of these beverages aren't what they are meant to be. And at the same time, you have people wanting something that is both nutritious and good tasting. And that's why you see some strength in factors like whole milk and fluid milk, while still continuing the decline in consumption we've seen for a lot of demographic reasons over the last several decades. That is a slow decline as opposed to this faster decline we're seeing as people are starting to abandon plant-based beverages.
Now, the NMPF recently submitted comments to the Food and Drug Administration's plant-based beverage proposal. And Birga notes how NMPF emphasized the importance of transparent product labeling to ensure consumer understanding.
As consumers are starting to understand that in the marketplace, these beverages are frankly trying to hoodwink them using dairy's health halo to convince them that these products are replacements when they simply are not. At the same time, you see the FDA starting to wake up to this a little bit and acknowledging the issue of consumer confusion over nutrition that's bedeviling these products in the marketplace for decades. We've been talking about this for decades, and at the end of the month, we submitted our comments about this proposed guidance on plant-based beverages to FDA, where we note that, you know, thank you for accepting our core argument. We appreciate that some of the disclosures that you are suggesting that plant-based beverage makers put on to show their demonstrated nutritional inferiority, that's appreciated. But what we really need is the FDA to enforce its own rules on labeling. Again, milk is an animal product. It's the process of thousands of years of development, nutritional integrity that in some ways, frankly, scientifically, we don't even understand. But we do know what milk is, and we know what milk isn't. And it's not something that comes from a plant. It's not something that comes from a lab. It's an animal product created by dairy farmers who are proud of the work that they are doing for this country and the world every day, and we need the labels to reflect that.
You can learn more about this on the National Milk Producers Federation website, nmpf.org. And the California Wool Growers Association will be holding their annual meeting and convention August 16th and 17th in Paso Robles. To see the convention schedule, go to their website, californiawoolgrowers.org. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
A new study links soil health and farm profitability. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. The Soil Health Institute and the National Association of Conservation Districts announced the results of a nationwide study showing how improving soil health can improve a farmer's profitability. The study shows farmers can build resilience across a diversity of soil types, geographies, and cropping systems. Among the key findings across 29 farms, soil health management systems increased net farm income by an average of $65 per acre. On average, when implementing soil health systems, it cost producers $14 an acre less to grow corn, $7 an acre less to grow soybeans, and $16 per acre less to grow all other crops. Yield increases were reported for 42% of farms growing corn, 32% of farms growing soybeans, and 35% of farms growing other crops. Farmers reported additional benefits like decreased erosion and soil compactation, earlier access to fields in wet years, and increased resilience to extreme weather events. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McOwen. For many years, a limit has been placed on the amount of government payments a farmer can receive each year. As the debate for a new farm bill heats up, so does talk about changing the limit on farm program payments. Proposed legislation would significantly change who receives farm subsidy payments and the maximum amount that can be received. General partnerships have been used for large farming operations to create a maximum of 6 payment limits totaling $750,000. To maximize benefits, you must also be actively engaged in farming, either by providing 1,000 hours of labor or an unquantified amount of time managing farming activities. The new proposal creates a hard cap of $250,000 annually in total commodity support for a farm operation. In addition, payment recipients must contribute at least 1,000 hours in farm labor or management and one half of the total time required to conduct farming operations. The bill allows family and extended family members to qualify as actively engaged without each member being required to meet their own individual service hour requirement. Crop share landlords are eligible, but cash rent landlords are not. If this is included in the farm bill, looks to me that it will lead to the creation of more two-person general partnerships. That means more complexity and, of course, more lawyer fees. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McOwen.
The Holstein Foundation's Young Dairy Leaders Institute, or YDLI, is now accepting applications for its next class. The engaging, hands-on event is open to young adults ages 22 to 45, working in any segment of the dairy industry. Director of Development and Fundraising for the Holstein Foundation, Deidre Harkenrider, was part of the group that launched the program 30 years ago.
We wanted to give them leadership skills so that they could become part of boards and forge their own futures.
YDLI focuses on strengthening young adults in growth mindset, team culture, advocacy, embracing change, community involvement, and more. The interactive three-phase program has graduated more than 700 alumni since its inception in 1993, like Heather LaPierre of New York.
YDLI challenges you in these three phases to learn more about yourself, and then to go out into the world and practice it, but then to come back together and share in that energy that everyone else brings to the room.
Many participants say they leave YDLI training sessions with a renewed sense of energy, drive, and passion for the dairy community. Program alum Mitch Kuppelman, a dairy farmer from Wisconsin, says he left with friendships and connections to last a lifetime.
With YDLI, I learned a whole new group of friends. So I think meeting people with similar activities, similar age, similar point in their careers was definitely my favorite part of YDLI.
While the program has evolved over the years, its mission remains to help create a vibrant dairy industry now and in the future.
What do people do once they get out of junior Holstein? Maybe they're just about out of college. What's that next thing? Where can they go to get some leadership experience? And that's why we put the program together, to build those leaders to help our industry and the ag industry, because we are the providers of, you know, protein and food for the not only America, but for the world.
Applicants selected for Class 13 of the Young Dairy Leaders Institute will be notified in early October. The group will meet for Phase 1 of the program January 28th through February 1st, 2024 in Tampa, Florida. And from there, everything is possible.
We all come together for the exact same goal, to support the dairy cow and to produce a great, healthy product. And so I find that graduates go on to do pretty amazing things. And whether it's their involvement with continued ag advocacy or whether they are involved on boards of their local communities, I love that that continues to be something that you see so many graduates continue to do over their lifetime.
For Holstein Association USA, I'm Bob Cervera.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Unused prescription opioid pain medicines can spell trouble.
They can spell risk if taken by someone they weren't prescribed for, harm if accidentally taken by a child or pet, or overdose if they're not used as directed. Safely dispose of opioids before they can hurt your family. Find a drug take-back option such as medicine drop boxes. You may find these in your community at local pharmacies or police stations. Visit www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour by AgNet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
In Farm and Ranch headlines from AgNet West, a number of factors are putting a drag on U.S. agricultural export values. Gary Crawford has more after this.
For the first 9 months of this fiscal year, the U.S. has exported ag products worth $141.4 billion.
It's down 7% from $152.1 billion this time last year.
And USDA economist Bart Kenner says U.S. ag exports have been slumping month by month by month since back in March. And Kenner counted for us down the monthly export amounts each month starting with March.
15.9, 14.4, 13.9, 12.8 from March to June.
Just a consistent monthly export decline. Lots of factors working. One, increasing production of many major crops in other countries also.
A big part of the story is price competitiveness.
Due to a stronger dollar, making U.S. goods more expensive on the world market. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
And I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Analysts continue to digest USDA numbers from Friday, making upcoming crop tours more impactful. I'm Mark Oppold with your bottom line report to begin second half of August, brought to you by Helena. No surprise, there are questions remaining after the August numbers from USDA Friday, especially in the soybean complex. Those private firms whose numbers differed widely from USDA, be it corn or soybeans or ending stocks, will now have to wait until September, October to either verify or reject their numbers. But next week's Pro Farmer Crop Tour will give everyone some immediate answers. Scouts there measuring fields a full three and a half weeks after USDA. Those surveys were done in late July. Keep that in mind. Rain events, certainly the first half of this month, have improved conditions, and those condition updates were not included in the report on Friday. This is the bottom line report. October live cattle will try again early this week to challenge the mid-July contract high, 185.75, but first things first, the August 4th high, 183.72, stands in the way. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day and a profitable week ahead.
During this blistering summer, millions of us are either coping directly with the record-breaking heat or certainly have heard news reports about it. It's big news.
More than 125 million Americans are under heat alerts. That's more than one-third of the United States population. In the coming days,
reportedly, thousands of people have been suffering heat-related illnesses. Hundreds have died from heat stroke this summer. And we are only just now getting into August, the hottest month of the year. And although some of us may say, "Meh, we're tough, and the heat doesn't bother us," one expert says,
heat stroke, heat illness is something we shouldn't just kind of glance over.
And so coming up, how to handle the heat, hopefully not let it handle us. On this edition of Agriculture USA, I'm Gary Crawford. When the weather records and journals are complete for this summer,
it is going to be one of the very warmest that we've ever seen.
Agriculture Department meteorologist Brad Rippey, perhaps the word warm missed is an understatement. Temperatures across the globe have been deadly hot. Many of those who work outdoors are being laid low by the heat. Some have died from heat stress and heat stroke. So to reduce the chances of our succumbing to the heat,
basically what we'd like to do is acclimate ourselves to the work environment.
Ohio State University Health and Safety Professor Dee Jepson.
You can't just go out and work a full day the very first day in the heat. You kind of have to let your body build up to that.
Especially if we're not seasoned outdoor workers and just deciding on day one to brave the severe heat and get all those jobs done around the place at one time, not a great idea, as demonstrated by these statistics.
When we look at outdoor workers in general, half of the deaths that happen to workers will happen on their very first day of the job. And 70% of any of the heat-related deaths occur within the worker's first week of the job.
So to use the technical term, take it easy in the heat. Just do a little work at a time out there and be kind to yourself with
rest, water, and shade.
and plenty of all three, especially, she says, water. She says, drink at least one cup of water every 20 minutes.
A lot of times people think, I don't want to drink that much. I'll be sick. If you're really out working in this heat, every 20 minutes, drink a cup of water. You'll feel much better.
Also, wear the lightest, loosest fitting, light-colored clothes you can get away with. And finally, here's one more clothing suggestion.
Throw away that beloved ball cap.
Oh, no.
It is not the best work hat.
Instead, she says, wear hats with at least a 3-inch brim all the way around them.
They block the UV exposure from your face, the top of your ears, the back of your necks. 80% of our skin cancer comes from that part of our bodies. So that tells us that we're not wearing the correct headwear to protect from the UV exposure.
But back to the immediate problem, the heat. Dee says even if you follow her advice to the letter, the heat still might start to get you because the symptoms can sort of sneak up on you.
Heat illness is really hard to recognize and hard to predict because each one of our bodies, you know, are so different.
And susceptibility to the heat varies with age and with the kinds of medications we may be on and with how acclimated we are to being in the heat in the first place.
And we also know that once a person has had heat stress or heat stroke, they are more susceptible to that again.
So we're going to try to touch on the general symptoms to watch out for in ourselves and in others, starting with mild symptoms and working up. And again, different folks will exhibit different signs of heat stress at different times. First,
if you get a heat rash or any type of prickly or blistery parts of the skin, that's showing that your sweat glands have become clogged. Your sweat glands are inflamed. The sweat cannot evaporate from your body.
Another early warning sign, heat cramps. But as the effects of the heat really start to intensify and become more dangerous, we may experience
fatigue or dizziness, even irritability, impaired judgment, any type of lack of ability to concentrate.
Things are really getting serious at that point.
Now the heat is affecting our blood flow into our brain. The body's trying to redirect that blood to release the heat from the skin. But when it does that, it kind of starts to affect us through our whole nervous system.
And at that point, we have to get cooled down and fast because Jepson says when our body temperature goes above 100 degrees for any length of time out in that heat,
that's in the fatal zone.
If you notice any of those symptoms, Dee Jepson says get out of the heat, get cooled down, get medical help. I'm Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the AgNet NewsHour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet NewsHour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet NewsHour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
Welcome back to the show. Today, our friend Chuck Zimmerman over at AgWire.com talked with David Magana, a Rabo Research Fresh Produce Analyst at the Ag Media Summit.
Yeah, David Magana here. I'm a senior analyst covering fresh produce and tree nuts for Rabo Research. My focus is North America, but I also obviously focus keep an eye on what's going on in South America as well, given particularly on the fruit side. Where as the U.S. relies during the off-season from imports, particularly coming from Peru, from Chile, and here in North America, I travel quite a bit to Mexico and all across the U.S. and also Canada.
Well, tell me a little bit about the panel that you were participating here at this Ag Media Summit.
it was a panel about the labor crisis, and so we were discussing with industry leaders how we got here to this labor crisis. And obviously, it's a long-term challenges and long-term trends that's how we got here. We were discussing all this and basically about geographical distribution of labor and how obviously this has been a challenge for years for agriculture. But during COVID, obviously, in other sectors, they felt this lack of availability of workers, also in the hospitality industry and things like that. But let's go one step back and just, like, understand what's going on. As an economist, I always put things in the supply and demand thing, right? So on the supply side of labor, we've seen drastic changes in demographics. It's no secret to anyone that U.S. agriculture, particularly in some regions such as Central Valley in California, has relied heavily on migrant workers coming from Mexico. And we see that, for example, natality rate has drastically declined over the past few decades, from an average of 7 children per family in the 70s to close to 2 children per family in nowadays. So I always put us myself as an example. I grew up in central Mexico in a region where they had excess labor, and I had 7 siblings, and then I have just 2 kids. So imagine that replicated in millions of families, right? So we see now that the cohort of workers from 15 to 35 years old in Mexico, it's been obviously in the 90s and just the past few years, it has still continued to grow. But now, starting now in the next few years, that cohort will start declining every year. So that's from the, and we see that, for example, reflected in migration patterns. After the Great Recession of 2008-2009, the net migration from Mexico to the U.S. was actually negative the decade after that. So now you see that that's on the supply side, right? On the demand side, you see that a lot more demand for ag workers in central Mexico, given that now you have industries that have developed really fast, particularly the berry industry, avocado industry, and other fruits as well that are export-oriented. And so now all those workers that are willing and are also able to work in ag in central Mexico, now they have an option in close to home. So central Mexico went from having an excess labor just 2, 3, 4 decades ago, now to have a deficit of labor. So now they are bringing workers from southern Mexico to work in these berry operations and avocados, things like that. So those are the underlying trends.
How about here in the United States? I mean, let's just take, say, Florida, say, or along the southern states. How would you describe the situation right now? Because we've long brought labor in where they've gone back home, whether it's Haiti or it could be Mexico or wherever.
Well, we see the aging of workers, and now you have, as I said, obviously, demographics have been changing. You have the demographic changes, you have generational changes. And now, for example, newer generations such as the centennials is not only the most diverse generation yet in the U.S., but it's also will be the most educated, with the highest degree of scholarity. So they will not be willing to work in ag as some of their parents did, or as because that's a very demanding job. However, I see it has two ways to see this, right? One is like we will continue to see declining availability of workers, but now given the preparation, given the abilities that these newer generations are going to have, we will have to see increasing innovation being part of the solution for this lack of availability of labor. So we will see efficiencies to make to help solve this problem. So innovation has been always the answer, and in this case, it will continue to be part of the answer.
Besides this labor issue, do you have some other key research you're doing in this fresh produce area you might want to mention?
Yeah, I published quite some reports on specific industries. For example, strawberries, blueberries, table grapes, avocados, pistachios, almonds, you name it. For example, for tree nuts, 2022 was a particularly challenging year, given that growers were facing elevated cost of inputs, and they were in the Central Valley in California. They were facing also lower than average yields because of the drought and deficit irrigation as well. And at the same time, due to logistical constraints and bottlenecks, the industry was not able to export as much as they could. So that resulted in very high inventories. So it was just the perfect storm between high input cost, low yields, and low prices because of these high inventories. For the past few months, we've seen that now in 2023, on the supply side, many factors have been improving. For example, including water situation, and in some areas, they went from having 0% surface water allocation in 21-22 to 100% allocation in 23. So that definitely helped with the cost side. Also, input prices, including fertilizer, come down from very elevated levels in 2022. And logistics continue to improve. The cost of containers and also availability of containers, things like that. However, we still are in a high inflation environment that is impacting the demand side of things. And we've seen that continues to be a challenge for some export markets.
For the ag journalists that are here at this particular conference, did you have a couple of specific points like this or others that you might want to make?
Well, we're working on a labor report. It's going to be a deeper dive on the causes and what's ahead on the labor situation. And I will be publishing also a table grape report that covers not only California or the U.S., but a global view of the industry, what's going on in the table grape industry, particularly with now increasingly operators are adopting new cultivars, and how the interaction between the supplies from different growing regions is impacting the market. So we have I have colleagues that work from Australia, New Zealand, and South America, Europe, and I cover North America. So we get together and we publish these reports. And after that, table grape one, we will be working on one on blueberries. So, yeah, like there is always
you certainly have a whole lot of choices of what commodities you might want to research, right?
Absolutely, this is a very diverse industry with over 400 different commodities. So obviously we focus on the ones that have the highest economic relevance. Time is the biggest constraint in terms of to do research, because there is a lot to do.
How do we get your reports? How do people, do they subscribe? Do they find them on your website or maybe all of the above?
There are some reports that are publicly available. For example, we published every other month the North American Agribusiness Review. That's, as the name says, we give up what we consider is relevant for a lot of different industries, all the way from farm inputs to consumer foods and everything in between, going from grains and oilseeds, sugar, animal protein, fresh produce, and so on. This is publicly available, and we publish that every other month. And there are other reports like the deeper dives that we've published, and we send those to our clients. So as a value add of the relationship that our clients have with the bank.
Well, thank you very much, David, for visiting with me here. We're at the Ag Media Summit taking place in Palm Springs, California. I'm Chuck Zimmerman reporting.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
We want everyone to breathe clean, healthy air, but California's traffic and mountains don't make it easy. Our mountains trap pollution, making us more vulnerable to dirty air. Today's farmers are voluntarily doing their part with help from USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service. How? By replacing older diesel-powered tractors and equipment, treating dusty farm roads, avoiding open burning, and more. Can't afford it? NRCS has invested $178 million helping California farmers clean our air. They can help you too. NRCS, helping people help the land since 1935.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
A free resource webinar is being offered to agricultural landowners next week. California FarmLink and several partners are offering a free webinar series, Land Access in California, Making Your Land Part of the Solution. The next workshop will take place between 4 and 6 p.m. on Wednesday, August 23rd. The webinar is designed for individual landowners and organizations that assist them, such as resource conservation districts, extension agents, and nonprofits. The workshop will help individuals to gain resources for assessing farmland, assessing readiness to lease to an agricultural tenant, learn about tools and resources for finding a tenant, and creating a secure agreement that supports climate resilience and healthy soils. The deadline to register for the webinar is August 16th, and more information is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
U.S. agriculture exports are running 7% below last year's pace.
For the first 9 months of this fiscal year, the U.S. has exported ag products worth $141.4 billion.
It's down 7% from $152.1 billion this time last year.
And USDA economist Bart Kenner says U.S. ag exports have been slumping month by month by month since back in March. And Kenner counted for us down the monthly export amounts each month starting with March.
15.9, 14.4, 13.9, 12.8 from March to June.
Just a consistent monthly export decline. Lots of factors working. One, increasing production of many major crops in other countries also.
A big part of the story is price competitiveness.
Due to a stronger dollar, making U.S. goods more expensive on the world market. One other factor, a
cooling global economy.
USDA projects ag exports for the year will be down 8% from last year's record high. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.